You're listening to Rendezvous with a Writer with Bobby Jean and Jim Bell, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to Rendezvous with a Writer, where readers and writers meet.
And story is everything.
We're your hosts tonight, Jim and Bobby Bell. You've been listening to Hot Texas by Hot Texas Swing Band. And
we are so delighted that you joined us tonight for episode 124. Mm-hmm. And we have special guest Mark Warren waiting to sign in. Here's Mark. Hello, Mark. Welcome.
Hello, Bobby and Jim.
We are so delighted that you're able to join us tonight. Where are you calling in from?
I am in the mountains of North Georgia, the southern tip of the Appalachians.
And do you have snow?
Right now, no.
No.
But we have had some.
You have had some.
Okay.
We're in Albuquerque, where spring is beginning to announce itself little by little. We are going to be talking about this incredible book of Mark's, A Last Serenade for Billy Bonney, a novel on Billy the Kid. And before we get started, Mark, Jim has a little bio he's going to share. And then we can't wait to get talking to you about this fabulous book. So take it away, Jim.
We got a lot of bio here. We got a two-part bio. As a Western historian, Mark has researched frontier history for more than 60 years, presenting at museums and cultural centers around the country. Mark has 18 traditionally published books. He has been honored by Spur Awards, the Historical Novel Society, and the Will Rogers Medallion Awards, and the Georgia Author of the Year Awards. And most recently, his book, A Last Serenade for Billy Bonney, won the 2024 New Mexico Arizona Book Award. His latest work is a duology on Nate Champion, Nate the Texas Story, and Nate the Wyoming Story. And now a little bio from the past, and maybe the present too. In addition to being an award-winning author, Mark is a U.S. national champion in whitewater canoeing, a winner of the World Championship Longbow Tournament. He is the founder and runs the Mexican Bow Wilderness School in the North Georgia Mountains, where he lives. Welcome, Mark.
Well, thank you.
Mark, I think we got the name of the wilderness school not quite right. Where is that wilderness school?
Well, you put me a little further south than Georgia. It's not Mexican Bow, but it's Medicine Bow.
Medicine Bow. Tell us a little bit about your background with wilderness and wilderness training. It's fascinating.
Well, I was born in love with the forest, and I had the freedom as a child to explore it, thanks to a good mother.
Yeah.
And to me, it was, when I was very young, it was all aesthetic. It was about appreciating what I was seeing and really not knowing what I was seeing. And as I got older, I developed a great thirst to learn about it all. So I finished in college with a completely different idea, heading toward going to medical school. I graduated in pre-med, but I had already begun my kind of private education on nature at that time. And that turned out to be the biggest study time of my life, learning about nature. So now I teach people about survival skills of the Cherokee and all kinds of classes about nature.
Mm-hmm. You wrote a book that I think I would really enjoy, Two Winters in a Teepee. You must have spent, that must have been based on personal experience, I'm guessing.
Yeah, that is nonfiction. That was about 2 years that I lived, straight through in a teepee in the forest. And even though the teepee really doesn't belong in this part of the country, it's a wonderful home that can be used anywhere. And the beautiful part about that story was that when you situate yourself in the forest on a permanent basis, not just as a visitor, but you're living there, you're putting yourself at the main intersection of nature, and just things are going to happen to you all the time. Wildlife encounters that you would never have had because you're there all the time. You're there to experience it. It's kind of like the tree falling in the forest. It's not heard unless someone's there.
So yeah.
I was there the whole time. So I heard all those trees fall.
Wow.
Were you with anybody or were you by yourself?
I was with my best friend, who was about a foot and a half tall with four legs, and she never wore any clothes except for a collar. That book is dedicated to my dog, Ellie. She spent that time with me there. But oddly enough, Ellie would not sleep inside the teepee. She slept outside always.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Was she a good guard? Did she alert you to things that you maybe wouldn't have been aware of immediately?
Yeah, she had some coyote in her blood mix, and I found her in the forest during an electrical storm. So we bonded very quickly. Yeah, she found refuge with me. She was scared to death of thunder and lightning, and that bonding turned out to be one of the most important friendships of my life. We were together for 14 years. And she lived those 2 years with me in the teepee.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I'm so glad we asked about this. That's so interesting.
It's true.
Thank you for
hearing. I was kind of curious about the longbow.
Longbow.
Yeah.
Well, I've been in love with bow and arrow for a long time. And the longbow appeals to me in a romantic way. I've always been interested in the history of archery and the development of the longbow in England, and I just love all that. So I got so involved in that I was shooting, as a passion, really. And then I found out how much fun the tournaments were, because it's not just shooting at a target. You're walking through the woods and coming to a station where there is a foam animal target. So it's built on the theme of hunting. But of course, nothing's hurt during this. And I enjoyed the competition quite a bit. I went to the world championships, I think about 9 times. And I always placed in the top 6 or 7. And then 1 year was my year,
Wow.
It could have been any number of people any year, but I had my year.
Oh, my goodness.
That's great. Now, were these contests all held in the States or they're worldwide?
Yeah, around the world?
This was the World Championships, but it happened to be stationed close to me because America's most famous archer was a man named Howard Hill. And he was a stuntman that you have no doubt seen in some of the old movies with Robin Hood. He was a phenomenal archer, and he was from Alabama. So the world championships were held in Alabama.
Okay.
Oh, that's fascinating. That's fascinating.
It is. Well, segueing over to canoeing. The same time? Did you compete at the same time? Or?
Yep. I won that position in canoeing the year after the year before I had won the archery tournament. But canoeing was another love of my life, and I feel like archery and canoeing were just waiting for me to pay attention to them and get to know them. Mm-hmm. And when I did embrace both of them, I found my sports most definitely. And this is after a lifetime of athletics. I found my real sports when I was in my 30s and 40s.
Wow.
So when did you start writing, Mark? Or were you writing throughout all of this time?
I started writing very young. I was probably 8 years old. And I used to put together books that I would literally bind with yarn. And so literally I was published, you know, because I was binding my own books. But I had a readership of two. That would be me and my mother. But as I got older and began to develop my writing with a little bit more ambitious goals, my first real effort in that direction was a novel which was about Robin Hood, but it was a modern day story. I wanted to place that legend into modern times. And I lost that book. It was handwritten.
I lost it
in a house fire.
Oh.
And I didn't have a copy of it. So it was a devastating loss to me. But I talked to a friend of mine who lived in New York. This is a girl who was a summer camper of mine. And she became, believe it or not, the personal assistant for David Letterman.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. So she had a lot of contacts in New York, and she was always reading my material and my manuscripts. And she finally said to me, what you've got to do is write a memoir, because that's what's selling right now. Mm-hmm. And to me, that didn't make any sense. Who would read a memoir about somebody they'd never heard of? Mm-hmm. But she convinced me to do it. So I decided to write about those 2 years that I lived in the teepee. That book is enjoying a really nice comeback right now. It was my first published work in 2012, but now it's enjoying a second wind. And I'm not sure why. Maybe the other books are leading people to that, but I'm real proud that that book is doing as well as it is.
Wow, that's so interesting. We're going to step away for just a moment. Just stay right where you are, Mark. We're going to hear a little spot from our sponsors, Blue Cottage and Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison. And if you're an author, you can find out what they can do for you. And here's that message. And we'll be right back with more with Mark Warren. Rendezvous with a Writer is sponsored by Blue Cottage Agency and Clicks by Madison, your author publicity and book marketing team. Experienced, trusted, effective. Contact them today at bluecottageagency.com.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. We're talking with Mark Warren. We've just been talking about his fascinating background, but we got to get into the book.
Oh, yeah.
My Last Serenade for Billy Bonney.
Oh, a novel on Billy the Kid. Mark, this is, and to our listeners, this is such an amazing book. Whether you think you know about Billy the Kid, I'll tell you, you don't. Until you read this book. this book, the prose in this book is lyrical and it's painterly. And there are times when I would read a passage and just close my eyes and imagine what I just read and went back to read it again. Your writing in this book is absolutely astonishing. And you've taken a subject that many of us think we know about, and you have blown it open, and you have taken us into a time and the world of Billy Bonney, Billy the Kid, in such a just an amazing way. And so congratulations, it's a fabulous book.
I appreciate your work so much. You just said to me the things that any writer would want to hear. Thank you.
You're welcome. It's worth a second and third read, because I think that I will find new things as I read it that I missed the first time through. The dialogue, we're going to get into this in greater detail, so I'm not going to jump into that right now. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book and what inspired you to address this look at Billy the Kid?
Well, I think my main goal in the book was, as it is anytime I write historical fiction, I want the reader to, first of all, get the correct history. That's important to me. The parts that I fill in that are creative are simply there to expand the story, to make it a more readable story. But I don't want to misrepresent history when I write these. But my main goal is to try to impart to a reader what my protagonist was really like. Not the myths that you hear of, but the real person. And so that's my first challenge, is to get into that person's head and understand them. And some of those subjects that I've written about have been pretty easy to get into, and some have been very difficult, but that's always the step one in the process.
Mm-hmm. Did you sit down and do a lot of research before, or you kind of researched this subject matter for a number of years?
Yeah, I've been researching it for a while. My first research began when I was 7 years old. And I know that's hard to believe, but as you know, in our generation, my generation, we grew up with Westerns, and they dominated television, of course. And so that's how we learned about our heroes. They were our heroes at that time. And so my interest certainly had to have begun there. But the very atypical thing that I did once was I saw a book that my brother had read. My brother's 2 years older. And he had done a book report on this book, and it was called Wyatt Earp, Frontier Marshal. And I read that book at that age, and I was completely taken by this character. And I'll tell you why, because I was fascinated with one trait of the human animal, and that is courage. That has always grabbed me and brought me closer to something, wanting to know more about it. And the way that book was written, it seemed to be about a man of immense courage. Now, I would find out later that that's not so true. That with Wyatt Earp, it was less courage than it was fearlessness. Two very different things. Mm-hmm. Courage is probably more commendable, because to show courage, you have to overcome fear. To be fearless, you just never have to go there. You're already there. You know, you're so confident.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning for me. And as soon as you get interested in one Western character, there's no way that you're not going to go find somebody else, because I can remember getting every book I could find about Wyatt Earp, but then I would get a more of a generic book about gunfighters, and I got it because Wyatt Earp was in there.
Yeah.
But then I would learn about Billy Bonney, and then I would get interested in him. Then I would start researching that. So that's the way it came about.
Yeah.
You want to tell a little bit of the background of the Lincoln County Wars and kind of what was going on at the time that Billy was at his
Billy comes into history.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's kind of hard not to mention this. To me, that kind of flashpoint of everything changes now for Billy was, you know, he was orphaned at age 14 or perhaps 15, and he was off into the world. Mm-hmm. He went to Arizona. He got in some trouble in New Mexico. So as a kid, so he was actually put in jail by the sheriff. Now, the sheriff says later he just wanted to scare the boy. But Billy doesn't know that. And Billy thinks he's incarcerated for a good long time waiting for the circuit judge. And he makes his first famous escape out of the chimney.
Yep, the chimney.
Yep. And just think about it. You're a 14-year-old kid. You're covered in soot. And you take off for Arizona territory to get away. And you're on your own.
Yep.
And he was a slight boy. He was not very strong. He was athletic in a cat-like way, but not necessarily with strength. He was probably about 5'6", maybe 130 pounds, 140 pounds, so smallish. And to think of a boy like that going off on his own to live in that rugged territory that was still so much of it was free range. So you had this tension between the cattle owners who were considered the barons and then the small ranchers who came in to make out claims on the land of the free range. You know, he came into an arena of trouble. And it was a battle of economies, really. And what had happened in Lincoln County, New Mexico, this one little cadre of very, very ambitious and cutthroat businessmen took over the county's mercantile business, and that means banking business, loaning money, and they had the contract for beef with the local Fort Stanton and Indian reservations, the Mescalero Apache Reservation. So these men were monopolizing everything. And when Billy steps into this scenario, he steps in right at the point where a newcomer from England has tried to wedge his way into this and compete with these men. And this is John Tunstall, the man who more or less becomes Billy's patron saint, offers him a job and makes gifts to him of horse, firearms, saddle. You can imagine what that meant to Billy. Now, Billy was a boy who had been turned down as a cowboy over and over. He just wasn't tough enough, they thought. Mm-hmm. He wasn't big enough to hold his own. So Billy had failed at this, and now this man was willing to take him on, plus give him all these gifts. And Billy, who had gotten into trouble, not real serious trouble, but the most serious thing that had happened to him was that in defending himself from a bully, in order to save his own life, he had shot a man who had died. Mm-hmm. And this man, Wendy Cahill, was a known bully, and he had just been asking for it for a long time. And he finally, he probably outweighed Billy by 100 pounds. Mm-hmm. And he got into a wrestling match with him and was beating him, had him pinned on the ground. And Billy worked a hand free and pulled a gun out of his belt and shot the man, as anyone in this world would have done in that situation. Mm-hmm. So that was Billy's worst crime up to that point. But by the time he met Mr. Tunstall, he had a record of theft and minor crimes, but he was now willing to go straight. He was going to go straight as an employee of John Tunstall. And then these very vicious, you can almost call them mafia-like people, a part of the Santa Fe Ring, one of the most corrupt governments in our history. Those people were threatened by Tunstall, and so they simply murdered him.
Yeah.
And so Billy is on the receiving end of this disaster, this terrible tragedy. And it triggers something in him. He's got to have revenge for Mr. Tunstall's death. Mm-hmm. And the revenge is so powerful in him because these men who committed it were so full of evil, greed, and willing to do anything to get ahead.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, this Tunstall guy was, you know, his employer. We talked about the kind of interesting job interview he had with Tunstall, but Tunstall, he's the first guy to really nice to him.
Yeah.
And actually gave him things and supported him. Most other people kind of like seemed like they were going to take advantage of him or just didn't want anything to do with him. But
Dick Brewer,
Tunstall really seemed to believe in him.
And Dick Brewer,
That's right. And what you really have to give Tunstall credit for there is that Tunstall probably met Billy at jail, where Billy was behind bars, and Tunstall offered him a job. Think about that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tunstall could have sworn out a warrant on Billy, and they could have acted on that and taken him to court. But instead, Tunstall offered him a job.
You, now, here's what Well, go ahead.
Here's what I think was the reason behind that. I think Tunstall was just now recognizing that he had been naive in the way he had come into this competition with the other, the mercantile company in Lincoln County. Mm. And he needed some guns. And he felt like Billy was someone who could help him in that way. Maybe that's why he gave him these guns as a gift, you know. But Tunstall was correct. Yeah. He did need that kind of help because naivety was exactly what he was experiencing there.
Mm-hmm. You capture Billy in such a remarkable way. The dialogue, all of the scenes that we get to hear Billy speak are just fabulous. This young kid, he has such a wit. And he has such an optimism, and he has what's that phrase he uses? Presto changio. Very, you know, he looks in with the life that he's had up till what you're sharing, and finds himself in this situation. He's just, you can't put him down. He's just constantly. He's sort of magical, and he's making fun, and there's a twinkle in his eye. And even when he's being threatened, you know, he's knows how to stand up to a bully, and he's like, you're not going to get me. He's just, you know, how did you, the writer, Mark, how did you capture Billy's soul so beautifully for us to enjoy?
Well, first I have to say this. You have been charmed by Billy the Kid.
Yes, I have.
That's what I wanted to get across, because that's exactly the way he worked. It wasn't a superficial or hypocritical of him to be that way. That was his way. And he was especially appreciated by young girls because they love that charm of his, and he was very polite. His mother had brought him up so well with manners, and so that charm showed up in many situations and won him friends. And the biggest segment of society that I would say was won over by him was the Hispanic people. They absolutely adored him. And a couple of reasons. One is Billy spoke Spanish as fluently as any Mexican, and they were very impressed with that. He was a good dancer, and you know how the Mexicans love their dances, and he loved to sing. He used to sing with his mother. I don't think Billy had any experience on a musical instrument, but he did love to sing. Mm-hmm. His favorite song was Silver Threads Among the Gold.
Yeah.
Did you know that?
Well, I read the book. You know that. It's mentioned a couple of times in the book. Mark, we're going to take another very short break. And when we come back, would you like to read something for us?
Sure, I can do that.
Okay. So we'll do that. We're going to take the break. We'll come back. We'll say hello to you again. And then we're going to have you read that passage. So here's another word from another one of our sponsors, our own online business, outwestshop.com. Take a listen to this. And when we come back, Mark is going to serenade us with a passage from the book. Don't go away.
Here at the Out West Shop, we're passionate about the American West, the truth and the myth. We're purveyors of fine Western goods. We scout for unique and distinctive apparel, accessories, home decor, and general merchandise that are a reflection of the Western lifestyle. We hunt for unique artisans and craftsmen who are inspired to create decorative art you can wear based on their own love for the story of the West. We round it up and bring it to you. Check out OutWestShop.com when you need anything Western.
Welcome back to Rendezvous with the Writer. We're talking about with Mark Warren, and what is his book here? It's Last Serenade for Billy Bonney. And I think Mark's agreed to read something.
Take it away, Mark.
Okay, let me set this up for you a little bit. Billy is in jail with several other of his cronies, and the law officers have allowed some reporters to enter the cell block to interview him because he's getting a little bit of a reputation now. Now, in that cell block happens to be one of the lead deputies, whose name is Barney Mason. And Barney Mason does not like Billy Bonney, does not find him amusing at all. So Billy is well aware of that, and he's telling this story to the reporters, and he's telling it about something that happens to Barney Mason and to Billy himself. And just to set this up a little bit more, this is a tall tale Billy's telling, but in the story, he has fallen into some abandoned mine shaft out on the prairie, and he's just stuck down there. All right, so here we go. "So there I am," Bonney says, crouching and spreading his hands with the flare of a seasoned raconteur. "About 100 feet down in the dark, looking up at a patch of blue sky that seems about the size of a dinner plate." He pauses to show his audience a solemn expression, and he holds a half-completed shrug as if his muscles have locked up. "I figure I'm a goner. The stone walls are wet and slick as bear grease. No way I can climb out of there." "But how do you survive the fall, Billy?" someone asks. Bonney stares down at the floor for a time. "Spider webs," he says at last. "Must have been thousands of them. When there's that many, you'd be surprised at what they're capable of." A murmur of laughter ripples through the crowd. "So what'd you do?" a man asks. "Well, I was damn lucky," Bonney goes on. "Old Barney Mason there come along." He points to the heavily armed deputy leaning against the wall to my right, and all heads turn to him. "Yes, sir, Barney was my salvation, even though it took 2 tries to get it right." The stoic guard ignores Bonney. Under the scrutiny of everyone in the room, he pulls a twist of tobacco from his pocket, bites off a chaw, and works on it with his jaws knotting. Bonney cups a hand beside his mouth and calls up to the ceiling of his cell. "Is that Barney Mason up there?" he calls out, now reliving the story like a stage actor. The crowd looks at the guard again, but he remains aloof, chewing and staring angrily at his boots as if he is enduring a diatribe on police brutality. "Barney's a little embarrassed, folks," Bonney explains. "You'll understand when I finish relating this story." Raising his head, the deputy fixes the prisoner with a loathsome glare. "What about it, deputy?" one of the reporters asks. "Is there any truth to this tale, or are we being hornswoggled?" Saying nothing, Mason stares at the man and chews in a steady rhythm. "So there I am at the bottom of the shaft," Bonney continues, "and I yell up to old Barn." Again, Bonney pretends to call up to the ceiling. "Can you help me get out of here?" Now the kid changes character. He frowns, puffs out his chest, and props his hands on his hips as he peers down into an imagined mine shaft. Deepening his voice, he adds a raspy texture for his Barney Mason portrayal. "Well, what do you want me to do, kid?" Returning to his own voice, Bonney calls to the ceiling again. "Have you got a rope, Barn?" He lowers his voice and delivers the answer to the floor. "Yeah, I got a rope. So what?" Bonney smiles and leans into the bars of the cell to deliver a confidential aside to his spectators. It goes like this for a few exchanges. "You see," Bonney flattens a hand beside his mouth as if to shield his words from Mason, but he whispers loud enough to be heard by everyone in the cell block, "Barney can be a little slow sometimes." Assuming his original storytelling voice, he continues, "It takes a while, but I finally convinced Barney that throwing a rope to me would be the answer to my prayers." The prisoner closes his eyes and flattens his hands together, palm to palm, before his chin. His wrist chains dangle briefly before settling into a quiet and lazy swing beneath his arms. Then he opens a rascally eye to make sure all are still with him. Breaking from his pose, he props his hands on his hips again. "So Barney disappears for a while, and I know he's fetching a rope. When he returns to the edge of the shaft, he yells down to me, "I still don't see how this is going to help you, kid." And I say, "Just throw her down, Barn." And he does. And right away, I realize he was right all along. That rope wasn't going to help me a lick. "Was it too short?" someone asked. With a sober expression, Bonnie shakes his head. "Nope, plenty long." "Too weak?" another man tries. "The kind to break on you?" Still solemn, Bonnie shakes his head again. "Nope, felt plenty strong." "Well, what was wrong with it?" a reporter queries. Bonnie shakes his head as if reliving the predicament right there in his cell. Leaning into the bars of the door, he lowers his voice to draw his listeners in. "Truth be told, weren't nothing wrong with that rope." The crowd went quiet, waiting for the riddle to be revealed. "So," Bonnie continues, "I yell up to Barney, 'Barn, you wouldn't have a second rope, would you?'" Now the storyteller assumes a startled expression. "And by God, against all odds, he does. So I holler up to him, 'Can you get that one now, Bard?' 'Sure,' he says. He's gone for a few seconds, and then he returns with his second rope. He yells down to me, 'What do you want me to do with this one?' And I say, 'Throw that one down, too.' After pondering over my request, Barney balks, saying, 'I don't see how this one's going to work out any better.' Bonnie addresses his punchline to the ceiling. 'This time, Barn, when you throw down the rope, could you hold on to one end?'"
Oh my gosh.
That's a great story.
Mark, he has just treated us to one of many, many, many passages like it from his award-winning book, A Last Serenade for Billy Bonney, a novel on Billy the Kid. Oh my goodness. So is there an audiobook, and is it all your voice, Mark? Because I would love to hear you read this book aloud.
There's not an audiobook. I wish there were, but I can think of a lot of readers I would prefer over me.
That passage, as soon as you started to read it, I'm like, I remember it. And that was just so funny.
You did an excellent job with that story.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Thank you.
Let's just talk about maybe a couple of the other characters that just jump off the page, Mark. John Blessing, this story, how did you and John Blessing meet, and how did you decide what role, very important role, he was going to play in this story?
Well, John Blessing is fictional, and he is, in this story, a choir director at a church in Santa Fe and a composer. Now, that's what John and I have in common. I'm a composer also. I've been writing music since I was 14. And that's been a really important part of my life. So John and I have the same wavelength with music, and we get along just fine together. But what I love about their relationship is that John Blessing comes from a so-called very cultured background. And so we think of him as the more civilized one. But as he gets to know Billy Bonney and admire Billy's courage and in taking a stand for certain issues, Blessing begins to question himself. What are his values? And would he be willing to make a stand like that? Mm-hmm. And he just grows into admiring the kid and seeing that there's a lot more to self-esteem than becoming erudite and learned and educated. That Billy has his own kind of education of life, and he just likes the young kid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it is, for the reader, again, so interesting. We start with John, and you weave John into the story as he's interviewing people that knew Billy and rode with Billy and have their stories about Billy. And then he's with Billy nearly the last day. We don't want to do a lot of spoiler alerts to the book. But then your epilogue, Mark, which carries John's story forward a bit. I just thought your epilogue tied the whole story together in such an unexpected kind of way.
Good.
And so we won't say anything about it because we want you to read the book. So you will also be awed by the epilogue. Do you want to ask about his teacher?
Yeah. That'd be the one next question. Character I like to talk about just briefly is Mary Richards, his teacher, I guess when he's about 14, right?
Yeah, Mary Richards was from England. And she had a very strong English accent. And I believe that this is one of the reasons that Billy was drawn to John Tunstall. Those may have been the only two people he had ever heard from England. But Mary Richards was his school teacher. And when she, you know, we have her exact words in describing Billy. She didn't see him as a particularly unusual boy or not particularly bad, not particularly good. He was kind of smallish and he had slender hands, kind of effeminate hands, and he was inclined toward the arts. But he just idolized her. And one of the things that they shared was that, well, first of all, Mary Richards spoke several different languages. She was really cultured. She'd been to college and learned several languages and could speak them fluently. And this was something that Billy related to, because as we know later, when he went off into New Mexico, he picked up the language from the Mexicans almost effortlessly. And this was one thing that may have endeared him to Mary Richards. Another was that both Billy and Mary were ambidextrous. And that's an interesting point that often circles around Billy's story, because it, as you well know, the old tintype, which shows images reversed, had the public misled for a long time that Billy was left-handed, which he wasn't. But, you know, it really doesn't matter because he was ambidextrous. He probably could have worn a gun on either side.
I'm looking at time. I can't believe how fast this is. This is just so delightful, Mark, to have you with us tonight. We're going to step away for one last announcement. This is a kind of an ad spot for where you can find Mark's books and all of the books of our guests who appear on Rendezvous with the Writer. And it's our Out West Shop affiliate page at bookshop.org. And when we come back, we're going to find out what Mark is up to next. Don't go away. Story is everything. Find a great one on Out West Shop's bookshop. Go to outwestshop.com, find books and CDs on the menu, choose Shop Out West on bookshop.org. Browse through featured authors on Rendezvous with a Writer. Explore curated book lists and our featured picks. Add in note cards, calendars, and jigsaw puzzles. One-stop shopping for great gifts. Use the search box to find thousands more titles. Make the switch. Your purchase supports us as independent booksellers. That's our story.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Rendezvous with a Writer. Special guest Mark Warren. Last serenade of Billy Bonney.
Billy Bonney. Mark, we do want to talk with you about what you have going on next, but we just wanted, was there anything else you would really like to share about this book before we move on to finding out what are you working on next? Anything you'd like to...
I'll tell you a funny thing that happens after you finish a book and it's been published. It becomes its own entity. You know, it leaves you. You've put so much into it, but once it leaves you, it's kind of its own being. And I have to tell you, when I got the news that this book had won the New Mexico Award in 2024 for Best Historical Fiction, my first thought was, way to go, Billy. Instead of giving me a pat on the head, I gave it to Billy because I feel like it's his momentum going forward, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, to talk about what's going on with me now, what I would really like to mention is the books that I have just finished publishing on Nate Champion.
Yes.
That's going to fit in best because it's another Western character, and the things that are coming out next for me are not Western. So let's talk about Nate Champion.
Absolutely.
If you ever need a hero and someone that you won't worry will ever be found out as being a phony, Nate Champion is the man to go to. I don't understand why he's not better known in American history. Everybody in Western history circles, of course, knows who he was, and they know his story. Yeah. But he is just not known around America like a name like Jesse James or Billy the Kid or Wyatt Earp. And he ought to be, because he saved the lives of at least 70 people without even knowing it.
Wow.
By putting up a last stand against 52 mercenaries who were hired to kill him. This is a man who had not broken the law, but he was lumped into this category of so-called rustlers simply because that's what the small rancher was called by the big rancher.
Mm-hmm.
But Nate was a young man who just had that dream of going off on his own and creating his own small cattle ranch. He came from Texas. He followed a cattle drive to Wyoming. He found his place. He went to work there first for the cattle barons. That's all you could do to begin with, to raise some money. And then he broke away and started his own small herd. But he got a reputation because he was a smallish guy, kind of like Billy was. But he was also known as someone you did not push into a corner because he would stand up for himself. And the cattle barons were trying to do that to him. The small ranchers had such a wonderful respect for him that in his absence, they voted him president of a new organization to help the small rancher compete with the large cattle barons. So he was this new top figure in this organization, and he didn't even know it.
Yeah.
And that's when this army came and surrounded the cabin where he was. He held them off for 8 hours.
Wow.
Now, his death was inevitable, but what he did during that time will just mark him into history forever. Not only did he hold off this army, but he also kept a running journal, handwriting it, of what was happening. And this journal survived his death. And it was printed in a newspaper. So we will always have that,
okay.
Even though we don't know where the journal is today. Yeah. But that journal tells you so much about Nate Champion.
Wow.
When I wrote these two books on him, I really worked backward by first reading what he wrote, seeing what kind of person he was, how he thought. And I took that all the way back to his youth to then develop him into that kind of person.
Wow.
He's a fascinating man.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for being with us tonight. Again, we've been speaking about his book, A Last Serenade for Billy Bonney. He's just told us about two books that you will want to be reading, the two Nate Champion books. Very quickly, we just want to mention who is with us next week. We're staying in the West, and author Susanna Lane is with us with her book, Enduring Promise. And of course, next week is the first week of the month of March. And so Henry Park, film editor for True West Magazine, is always with us the first Thursday of the month.
If somebody wants to get a hold of you, Mark, how did they do it?
Email would be the best way. I have a website. They can go to Mark Warren Books, and my email address is there so that someone could contact me that way.
That's great.
Very good.
Do you have a very quick quote?
I have a quick quote.
And maybe LA Talk Radio will let us stay on an extra moment.
Yeah, this is this shows the upbeat personality, you know, Billy plus his use of aliases, which he had a lot. he's about ready to spend a couple of days in the slammer. In other words, the sheriff's about ready to put him in jail. And he's going by Henry. And Henry looked around at the dirty walls and floor of the jail. The place was less than a year old, but appeared not to have been swept out in months. The bed smelled like a pair of worn-out socks pulled off a dead man. Henry said, "It ain't so bad."
Optimistic, always. Thank you, Mark, and thank you, everybody, for being with us. Look for episode 124, where you, stream your podcast. And
as we always say, it's always a great day out west.
Keep writing. We'll keep reading. See you on the trail.
Thank you, Mark.